In my family, education means cultivating wisdom and virtue by teaching what is good, true, and beautiful. Memoria Press makes this type of education possible with their classical Christian curriculum. Characterized by simplicity, quality, and affordability, Memoria Press gives my children a rich classical education. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk about the moral decline of the United States. It's a very complicated question. We often want to say, when did it start? How did it start? What was the trigger point for these things? It's not one thing at all, but we could name a few. We could talk about the divorce culture in the United States. We could talk about the divorce of sex from reproduction. That is artificial contraception. Now, however you feel about contraception, you have to admit one of its results has been the ability to disconnect sex from conceiving children. What about the prevalence and even the church's acceptance, tacit acceptance, of living together before marriage, cohabitation? And then, of course, more in the result category, the rise of the homosexual and transgendered movements. We're going to be talking about all of those things as we talk about a Christian response to the moral revolution. Dr. Albert Mohler joins us for the next 45 minutes of Issues, Etc. on this Monday afternoon, November the 9th. He's president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, host of a daily podcast called The Briefing. His latest book among his numerous titles is called We Cannot Be Silent. Dr. Mohler, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Todd, it's always great to be with you. Thank you.
How do you respond to someone who says, look, I'm concerned about all these changes in the sexual revolution, you call the moral revolution, with regard to family, parents, children, marriage, all these things, but these things are cyclical. The pendulum's swinging to one side in our society today, and it's sooner or later going to swing back closer to the center. Things will return to normal soon enough. What do you say to that?
Well, I could wish that it were true, but the historical record just really doesn't verify that at all. As a matter of fact, what we have is an easily traceable pattern in which empires rise and fall, and there's no return to some kind of mean. I mean, you look especially at the great Christian theologian Augustine and how he dealt with the fall of the Roman Empire, and he quickly understood that that what would follow the fall of that empire would not be some kind of return to a status quo ante. It would instead be a new situation with tremendous dangers and with horrible human cost. And that's what we're looking at. We're down to the redefinition of marriage. And it's not like you can somehow return to some mediating position, some middle position on this. This is a society that has swallowed something of a poison pill here, and we're in uncharted territory.
You talk about the secularization of both society and of culture here, and most people, when they hear that, think you're advocating for some kind of return to an ideal theocracy or something. But you're talking about something, not just the removal of the symbols and ideas of religion from society, but also a rejection of those things and the foundations on which they're built. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting, Todd. When you look, for example, at major political leaders who were not clearly identified as Christians during the 20th century, even as they claimed a rather secular identity, they were clearly working within a Christian frame of reference. And you take someone like a Franklin Roosevelt or a Winston Churchill, and then you fast forward to where we are now. We're operating with those who are amongst the intellectual elites and largely in control of cultural production in this country and the political process and the courts. They're increasingly no longer operating out of an inherited Christian worldview. And I'm not saying that before you're talking about people who are regenerate believers, but they were operating out of an essentially Christian moral universe. And now that's no longer the case. But to get to the last part of what you were saying, it's not just that they are no longer working out of that framework. The framework that gave us, by the way, the very understandings of human liberty and human dignity that that are central to the American experiment, they're no longer just not operating out of that worldview. They're explicitly repudiating it in increasing numbers. That's a very new thing for us.
All right. So, again, it's not a kind of neutral position. that we're encountering here. They're not calling for religious neutrality in the name of secularism, are they?
No, and there really is no such position. That's the great secularist myth. And so when you have this kind of secularization take place, eventually religious liberty becomes a very difficult thing to maintain. And so you look at Europe, and so there you had a guarantee of religious liberty, but it's giving way to modern definitions of hate speech, and so the only way you can have the new moral regime in place is if the Christian moral understanding is not just marginalized, but increasingly repudiated, and we're watching that in this country now as well.
What's the relationship between the sexual revolution, with all of its particulars that we can discuss here in time, and the moral revolution? What's the relationship between those two things?
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize the moral revolution it comes hand in hand, but before and behind the sexual revolution. So when people look at the sexual revolution, for instance, in the 1960s, and we know there were roots before then. It didn't come out of a vacuum. One of the things I demonstrate in the book, We Cannot Be Silent, is the fact that you couldn't have that sexual revolution without two things that came before. And one of them, by the way, was the development of contraceptives and birth control, because that became the technological facilitator for the sexual revolution. And you really couldn't have those unless you had a major moral shift on that question. And most evangelical Christians are shocked to know that there wasn't a single denomination on the planet that affirmed the morality of birth control at the beginning of the 20th century. So, and that came basically in the 30s and the 40s, starting, we should note, with the Church of England. And then the redefinition of marriage at the level of divorce, that really came before anyone was even talking about same-sex marriage, and is in many ways a completely fundamental redefinition of marriage in terms of making it just a contract between two parties as long as both of them want to be married. And that represented a massive moral shift, again, away from a Christian understanding of the permanence of marriage towards something else. All that had to take place before the sexual revolution could gain steam.
So both the technology, as in artificial contraception, and the legal framework, as in no-fault divorce, were the precursors and the prerequisites to what we see today.
Yeah, you couldn't have, for instance, the legalization of same-sex marriage if marriage hasn't been vastly modified in moral terms before you get to same-sex couples. And I think that's where a lot of conservative Christians think that somehow history begins in 2003 or with the Obergefell decision in 2015. That's just not true. We are now reaping a whirlwind, but the wind was sown decades before and by, frankly, our parents and grandparents when they weren't even aware of what was happening.
Let's talk about how the advocacy for homosexuality, the homosexual movement, for lack of a better term, fits into all of this.
Well, you know, it's really interesting that every major movement in Western societies is generally driven by an activist core who are overwhelmingly, unconditionally committed to the cause. And there's no doubt that there was a group of activists who coalesced, especially in the late 60s and the early 70s, in order to push for the normalization of same-sex relations. And some of them even dared to dream of something or to use phrases like, same-sex marriage. But that seems so far out of the moral possibility in the United States that even 5 or 6 years ago, there were those in the gay rights movement that became kind of rebranded LGBT who were arguing that it wasn't yet time for same-sex marriage. But that revolution took place in less than 5 years.
And it came along with or was attended by, I'm not really sure how this happened, chicken or egg, with what you know to be a real major shift in the majority of American opinion on that subject.
Yeah, you know, what is so stunning on this one is that when you look at moral change reflected in polls and surveys, you generally have to look at being on the other side of a major event such as the Holocaust, that'd be one, or you're looking at generational change measured over 30 to 40 years. Even pollsters are completely shocked by the same-sex marriage issue because you have people who are basically the very same people, answering differently in a 5 to 7 year period. And so you're dealing with these vast surveys being done in which 70% of the American population at one point says same-sex marriage should never be legalized, and then 70% of the population roughly is saying it should be. And you're talking about 5 years' time. That's not enough time for a generational shift, and we didn't have a world war. So something, morally speaking, has to explain that vast shift in just a matter of a half a decade.
What it sounds like to me, Dr. Moeller, is that that those who were answering those survey questions opposed to a redefinition of marriage and same-sex marriage were not prepared philosophically or theologically to have that position challenged. And when challenged, they caved.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think the other thing you have to add to this is the power of the popular culture. And as it turns out, and you're not surprised by this, nor am I, the vast mainstream of America, it turns out, largely makes moral judgments based upon the direction they believe the culture is going. And even though few of them would admit that, that seems to be now incontrovertibly the case. And so when you've got Hollywood, USA Today, by the way, ran an article saying that, Hollywood should be the honorary best man at every same-sex wedding. I mean, when you've got Hollywood, you've got the major college and university campuses with the academic culture, you've got the culture of the guilds, especially the legal societies, and you've got all of this coalescing around support for same-sex marriage, unless you've got a very strong biblical worldview, it's very unlikely you're going to hold to that moral conviction against it.
Dr. Albert Moeller is our guest. We're talking about a Christian response to the moral revolution. He's president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and author of the book, We Cannot Be Silent. Folks, you can help us provide artillery for the church militant on the front lines by joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. It's our monthly or annual giving program. And if you join by tomorrow, November the 10th, that's Martin Luther's birthday, we'll send you a limited edition Here I Stand long sleeve t-shirt in addition to the other membership premiums. Find out more about the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by clicking the Here I Stand t-shirt at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call Craig 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Albert Moeller. We'll talk a little bit about Glamour magazine recently naming transsexual man Bruce Jenner Woman of the Year. Stay tuned.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Standing Firm in a Hostile World is the theme of the San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, February 5th and 6th. This confessional Lutheran conference features Issues Etc. guest Adam Francisco, David J. Weber, Joe Abrahamson, attorney Mark Stern, and Professor Alan Quist. If you're in Texas or would like some warmer weather in February, check out the San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, February 5th and 6th at faithlutheransa.org. FaithLutheranSA.org.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century. The 21st century.
As my forefathers, in which I see.
the best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Albert Mohler is our guest, author of numerous books, including his latest, We Cannot Be Silent, talking about a Christian response to the moral revolution. I don't think anyone, Dr. Mohler, could have predicted how quickly transsexualism gained public acceptance, but it was just recently the Glamour magazine named transsexual man, Bruce Jenner, Woman of the Year. How did we get to this?
Yeah, this is a basic leap into irrationality, and it won't work because of the very reasons you just raised. You know, there's so many things to talk about here. For instance, if you're just going to, let's just use the name Caitlyn Jenner for a moment, who is not a woman, but is being celebrated as Woman of the Year, and frankly, is presenting as a woman, but not just as a woman, but as something of a glamour bombshell. You'll notice that the transgender revolution is not following the supposedly feminist script that women should not be reduced to sex objects. And how in the world is the elite liberal culture that had said women shouldn't be treated as sex objects, how all of a sudden do you celebrate any woman or someone who's identified as a woman in terms of Glamour magazine and Vanity Fair's cover? There's an internal contradiction here. It's just not going to work. And furthermore, the meltdowns are going to come in ways that I think the left is just not going to be able to handle, but we're all going to be, you know, dealing with the inevitable human cost to all of this.
What it looks like to me again is the kind of the illogic of the left has painted them into a corner, and in, as you've just said, into some real direct conflicts with other major tenets of their faith, so to speak. Feminism.
Yeah, how can you have a woman's college? You know, the driving energy so much of the feminist movement has come from these, you know, the seven sisters of these liberal arts colleges that are historically women's colleges, and you know, no men on campus. So what do you do now when you've got someone who was born a boy and now claims to be a woman? What do you now have someone who is admitted as a young woman who then wants to identify as a man? I mean, you really can't have an historic women's college anymore. And so the left has said, we are entirely for feminism and the logic of feminism. Now we're entirely for the logic of the transgender movement. Well, you can have one, but you can't have both.
All right. This leaves us in a position, just to pause for a moment here before we regroup. This leaves us in a position where I think most people's heads are spinning. Certainly my head is spinning. That means that my parents' generation, people who are in their 80s, their heads are spinning. They can't even conceive of these things.
Right.
Is there any silver lining to the cloud we are observing here?
Well, the collapse of cultural Christianity around us, the moral revolution around us, is going to come with huge moral, huge cultural, huge social cost. There's no doubt about it. Society is going to be severely and horribly negative in terms of the impact that's going to befall it. But when it comes to the church for whom Christ died, this is an opportunity for the gospel to be shown in its direct contrast and relief to the wisdom of the world. And the collapse of cultural Christianity, which comes with this moral revolution, it's going to hurt the culture, but it will not hurt the church. And so if there is a real opportunity here, it's for the church to stand by the inerrant and infallible Word of God and to stand by all of the truth claims of the Christian religion and to stand by the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ as the only wisdom that could possibly defy this this horribly confused wisdom of the world.
Do you see any limit to the lengths? I'm not talking about the tactics, but the direction, really, the vector that the sexual revolution can now go. Is there anything that would limit it at all?
No, you know, if you look back to the age of the Soviet Union, and there's some really important documentation of that era coming out, it was clear that the Soviet authorities eventually understood that so long as the church existed, claiming that Jesus Christ is Lord, it would in every case be subversive of the idolatrous claims of the Soviet regime. That's basically the same position the early church was in over against the Roman Empire and Caesar claiming to be Lord. This new moral revolution demands total obedience. And I don't think there are any limits to how far they're going to press the coercive power of this new morality in this society. I serve as president of a seminary. You know, those who are presidents of colleges and seminaries that will seek to be faithfully Christian, enormous pressure, and some of it direct, some of it indirect. Christian business people, Christians in public office, there are going to be some really horrifying prevailing pressures against us. And to be a young Christian on a college or university campus today is going to be to face the onslaught of peers, of professors. We should not underestimate the challenge we're up against.
All right. How much of this has been not just well-orchestrated, well-funded, but also very cleverly achieved through political purposes or through political means that has walked around the average person, in particular in the American context, done an end run around the average voter?
Yeah, you know, this was not, in almost every case, won by a political victory at the polls, but rather through political activity in the courts. And I think that's really important to note. And so with very few exceptions, same-sex marriage, wherever it's been legalized, has been legalized by a court. And certainly in the United States, that is now the case with the Obergefell decision. And so that's one of the lessons that conservative Christians need to understand, is that politics is more than what takes place in the electoral process and in the polls. And the end run is to go around the polls and go around the voters to the courts. And that is how so many of the so-called progressive causes in this country have been driven. And then some of them, by the way, were undeniably righteous, such as, you know, the end to segregation and so many other evils. But when you're looking at this moral revolution, it's they've tried to follow the same handbook, and they've done so brilliantly.
You mentioned Obergefell several times here, the decision wherein same-sex marriage was essentially legalized in all 50 states recently. Do we Christians, and even those who may not be Christian but still want to retain a Christian worldview, who are disturbed by these things, although not by reason of religious faith, do they need to understand Obergefell as not just a marriage decision but a religious liberty decision?
Yes, profoundly so. That was made clear in the oral arguments. I mean, we all knew it was shaping up this way. But just look at the record of the oral arguments in the case, where you've got the Supreme Court's Chief Justice, John Roberts, asking the Solicitor General of the United States if a religious college that has housing will be required to house married couples, according to the state, who are of the same gender, if they offer married housing to heterosexually married couples. And the Solicitor General said, and these are just horrifying words, he said, quote, "it will be an issue," end quote. In their dissents, you had several of the justices, including the Chief Justice, say after the decision was handed down June the 27th, that this is a devastating direct threat to religious liberty. This isn't hypothetical. It's very real.
We're talking to Dr. Albert Moeller, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, about a Christian response to the moral revolution. When we come back, what does marriage mean now? What does it mean now that anyone and everyone can not only claim but also procure the right to marry? We'll answer that question on the other side of the break. And after about another 10 minutes, after our conclusion of our conversation with Dr. Moeller, we'll be teaching a Sunday school lesson on the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapters 19 and 20 with Pastor Tom Baker of Law and Gospel. That's hour two of Issues, Etc. We talk about those Ten Commandments as really the fulfillment of a promise that God had made to Moses back at the burning bush. What does that mean? We'll answer that in about 20 minutes here on Issues, Etc.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
We talk to the biggest names in religion today, liberal bishop John Shelby Spong.
I don't don't think Jesus ever preached the Sermon on the Mount, for example. I don't believe anybody ever took five loaves and two fish and fed 5,000 people. I don't believe that's possible to do.
Liberal Bible critic Bart Ehrman.
There's a difference between what the historical Jesus actually said and what the Gospels say he said. And to understand what the historical Jesus was really like, we have to get behind the Gospels.
Muslim critic of Christianity Reza Aslan.
By definition, the resurrection is an ahistorical event, and so therefore historians have no right, no business commenting upon it.
Where else on Christian radio will you hear these guests challenged with important questions? Talk radio for the thinking Christian, Issues, etc. Listen live or on demand at issuesetc.org.
South Africa.
China.
Germany.
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues, etc. around the world? India.
Sweden.
Egypt.
France.
Turkey.
Japan.
Australia.
Canada.
United Kingdom.
Hong Kong.
Austria.
Finland.
Malaysia.
Singapore.
Bulgaria.
Korea.
Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines.
Mexico.
Spain.
New Zealand.
Kuwait.
Welcome back. This is Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Albert Mohler is our guest. We're talking about a Christian response to the moral revolution. He's president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, host of a daily podcast called The Briefing, and author of numerous books, including his latest, We Cannot Be Silent. Dr. Mohler, coming to the subject of marriage per se, what does marriage mean now? The word itself, what does it mean now that everyone can claim and procure the right to marry?
Yeah, well, you know, I think I have to answer that two ways. And one of them is to say that in the culture around us, all marriage increasingly means is a relationship that is recognized with some legal status between two people for so long as they want to be recognized in that status, so long as they want to be recognized in that commitment. That's basically all it means. And that's not just for same-sex couples, but that's even for heterosexual couples, because no-fault divorce means that's basically, it's just a contract for so long as both parties want to remain married. But the second way I have to answer that is, say, for the church, we have no choice but to define marriage exactly as it's defined in Scripture and fully as it's defined in Scripture. And so what we're finding ourselves is that for the first time, the believing gospel church is going to define marriage in a way that is dramatically different than the culture around us. And that's something our grandparents and our parents didn't have to face. And, you know, I've been in pastoral ministry for 30 years, and I didn't face this as a young pastor, but every pastor is going to face it now.
Does it mean legally or at least culturally that marriage as a privileged institution, especially legally, is coming to an end?
Well, you know, that's the issue. Folks were demanding the so-called right to marry because they wanted in on those privileges. And every society, in one way or another, no matter how secular, it ends up having to regulate marriage with a certain set of privileges in one way or another. I mean, it comes right down to the fact that someone's got to make decisions about to whom children belong, who can make decisions in a hospital room. And then, of course, yeah, every society in its own way has tried to subsidize marriage for the procreation of children by tax benefits and other kinds of benefits that are bestowed by the society. Right now, what we're seeing is that marriage is being redefined so that people can get into that privilege. But, of course, that undermines the entire project. And so I think inevitably we're going to see that marriage becomes just a social option if we follow the logic of this revolution.
What are the consequences of that? You said uncharted territory a few moments ago, and I cannot think of a parallel in history, or especially in our history, where we know what happens next after that.
Yeah, I think that's really the point, and that's the most terrifying part of this. You know, just consider what this means for children. I mean, for every generation before ours, having a child meant a husband and a wife, or at least a man and a woman, coming together to have a child. And the context of marriage was the socially sanctioned, the only socially sanctioned and recognized context in which that was honored by society. Well, now having a child can happen in a laboratory. At least you put the quotation marks around having. And so, but every time you say, you know, a male-male couple having a child, well, obviously they're not having it together. And the same thing with two women. And so we're already looking at, well, what is parenthood going to mean? What does relatedness even mean? And we're not only are we in uncharted territory, quite frankly, even those driving this revolution have no idea where this is taking us.
The solution that has been timidly suggested by some of the church, and in some cases not so timidly, is that the church is simply on the wrong side of history with these things. The church needs to get with the times and needs to practice the kind of tolerance that society is calling for it to do. How is that for a solution?
Well, it's a great solution if the Bible's not the Word of God, and if the gospel of Jesus Christ is something we can transform and redefine, and that we have the right to do that. But the fact is that if the church ever follows that logic, there is no end to it, and it's just the abandonment of the gospel. It's the abandonment of historic Christianity. It's the abandonment of the faith once for all delivered to the saints. We're really not under doubt. We're not living in doubt as to what the Bible says the gospel is, and what it identifies as sin, and what it defines as marriage. And the Christian church, if it's going to stand on some authority other than the authority of the Word of God, and that faith once for all delivered to the saints, as made clear in the creeds and confessions of the church, then frankly, we don't even know what Christianity is. And that's the path liberal Christianity has taken, the liberal Protestant denominations. It's the experiment the Roman Catholic Church seems to be determined to set itself upon, even in recent days. But the gospel-believing church can't go there. We are, so to speak, gloriously stuck with Jesus and the apostles. There's no other place I'd want to be. But that means that at times, long before we arrive in 2015, the church has been told it was on the wrong side of history. And by the way, that may be even be true. We may be on the wrong side of history, but we're not on the wrong side of eschatology.
This raises thorny questions for the individual Christian, for the Christian congregation, for church bodies and institutions, as you mentioned before. Simple things like, and all of them kind of, the entire complex of religious liberty and the redefinition of morality play into it. Like you ask questions like, should a Christian simply attend a same-sex wedding of a loved one or a friend?
Well, the answer to that has to be no, in particular because of the unique character of a wedding. You know, I just keep reminding people that that a wedding is a public celebration of a union and the public validation of the union. That's made clear, for instance, in the Book of Common Prayer language that almost every traditional Christian wedding liturgy or wedding service in the United States is used. You know, if there be anyone present who knows any reason why these two should not be lawfully wed, let him speak now or forever hold his peace. Well, if you stay, that means you're saying it's right. And that's the problem with attending a same-sex wedding. You are saying by your presence that it's right. And it's not. That's the problem. You're validating what you know to be invalid.
It raises questions that have been much in the news. People who run businesses and attempt to do so while retaining their Christian moral principles also don't want to be forced to participate in any way in these kinds of things. Do you see a legal solution for that anytime soon?
You know, I really don't see a legal solution. I don't think right now there's, in most places, I don't think there's the political will to resist this moral revolution. That's the big problem. And so even with a presidential election looming before us, I really don't believe that even most political conservatives have the political will to do anything effective in terms of the law. And quite frankly, living through this moral revolution at present means that I'm not sure that there is the political will on the part of the American people, the very people who are answering the surveys and polls we just talked about. I don't think there's going to be any rescue from the political process.
You mentioned before, and we have many times in this conversation, the new morality. It's not as though it's not as though morality itself has been tossed out. It's almost as though there's a new Decalogue that has been written. What is the new morality that is as vociferously legalistic as any old morality ever was at any time?
No, that's a brilliant insight. You know, every society operates by a morality because it has to. There's a vision of the good life, of the right life, of acceptable conduct that's upheld by every society. And by the way, everyone in this sense is a moralist. We're just selective where we are moralistic. For example, there's a recent article arguing that as concern for sexual morality goes down, concern for the morality of food goes up. So you go from worrying about premarital sex to free-range chickens and how free-range a chicken must a free-range chicken be. And so you look at this, you realize, wow, you know, you look at everybody's a moralist. We're just selective in terms of a lot of our moral concerns. And the new morality that's in place basically says that personal autonomy is the great and good. That personal autonomy is God, and thou shalt have no other gods before personal autonomy. And, of course, there are severe limitations to that. Number one, we're so, and the Christian worldview explains why, we're so incompetent as autonomous creatures, we can't even maintain an understanding of the autonomy that we demand. But that is the first principle, and then you've got a new morality based on what follows from that, which has to be relativistic when it comes to sex, and now even gender identity. And so the new sexual morality is you must have no moral absolutes when it comes to sex, And then they try to hold forth a sexual morality of consent. That's what you see going on college campuses now, this affirmative consent. But then you've got to define what consent means in every little situation. And I can't even go into the discussions going on campuses because, frankly, it'd be pornographic. But they're not less concerned about sexual morality. They're more concerned about sexual morality. It's just an unworkable, horrifying new sexual morality.
You use the word unworkable, a writ large for a society. Can a free society continue under this new morality?
No, I think the place to see the verification of that judgment is on the American college and university campus, especially secular universities or the elite private universities, where these new sex codes are absolutely unworkable. They're just on their face ludicrous. In which you're trying to tell, you know, 18 to 22 year old males and females that they have to get permission to touch this and then to touch that, and they have to be able to verify that they got permission. That is manifest nonsense, and yet it's being put forward with a straight face by college administrators, and they themselves know that it's unworkable. They're going to end up college and university administrations are just going to be basically given over to sexual behavior review committees. They're going to have to give up raising money and recruiting students because they're not going to have any time.
Finally, what do you say to the Christian listening to us who says, I fear for the future of my church and for the future of my children and my grandchildren? What do you say to them?
Well, I do too. I'll be honest. I fear the kind of world they're going to inhabit, and I fear the inevitable injuries and evils that will befall a country that's bought into this kind of moral insanity. But I also have to remember that God is sovereign, and that Christians have lived through tougher times than this. You know, one of the things I have to remember is that in the Roman Empire, mothers had to send out their, you know, 15, 16-year-old sons to get bread, and they'd have to walk by public debauchery in order to bring back, you know, bread from the marketplace. Somehow they had to be able to raise their children to be faithful Christians in the midst of some of the most horrifying public immorality, especially when it comes to sex. And the church has lived under the oppression of Hitler and has lived under the oppression of Rome. We've had tougher moments in the history of the Christian church than this. So we dare not say that Christ Church is not up to this challenge. We just dare not say that.
Dr. Albert Mohler is president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's host of a daily podcast called The Briefing, and he's author of numerous books, including his latest, We Cannot Be Silent. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Mohler, thank you so much for your time, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Todd. I appreciate your ministry. It's always a worthy conversation. God bless you guys.
When we come back, we are going to be teaching a Sunday school lesson with Pastor Tom Baker in Exodus chapters 19 and 20, the Ten Commandments. Stay tuned.
You might wonder, is it possible for my child with special needs to receive a rich classical Christian education? Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope answers yes. With the Simply Classical curriculum created by Cheryl and published by Memoria Press, there's no reason to withhold a beautiful education from any struggling student. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR. classicalspecialneeds.com.
Do you have a hard time finding Christian greeting cards and gifts that aren't either sappy or theologically suspect? Ad Crucem offers the perfect combination of art and the truth of the scriptures with beautiful and reverent greeting cards and gifts. Deliver the true comfort of the gospel, Christ crucified for sinners, to family and friends with Ad Crucem. ADCRUCEM.com. Confessing the faith through art and word. AdCrucem.com.
Talk radio for the Christian worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly, or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly, or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly, or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly, or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club.